This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Killing the Deep State, The Fight to Save President Trump by Jerome R. Corsi, Ph.D., narrated by Dan Crew. Introduction. You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Hillary Clinton, September 9th, 2016. On July 26, 2017, under a search warrant obtained by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller, the FBI conducted a pre-dawn raid on the Alexandria, Virginia home of former Trump campaign aide Paul Manafort, even though Manafort had testified voluntarily to the Senate Intelligence Committee on July 25th and was cooperating fully with the special counselor's investigation into the Trump campaign's collusion with Russia. At Mueller's instruction, the FBI picked the lock of Manafort's front door and burst into his home while he and his wife were sleeping. This raid smacked of government prosecutorial impropriety, with Mueller using police state strong-arm tactics to intimidate a target of the investigation. Mueller's intended result was to strike terror not only into the hearts of Manafort and his family, but also into the minds and hearts of any Washington operative still supporting President Donald J. Trump. Given that Manafort was cooperating with Mueller's investigation, it is likely that the pre-dawn raid yielded documentary evidence that Manafort would have handed over willingly had the Department of Justice bothered to ask. What the Gestapo-like break-in signals is that Mueller, as special counselor, has joined forces with the Democratic Party, the mainstream media, and deep state intelligence agency operatives who are out to destroy the Trump administration. In the eyes of the deep state, Trump dared to suggest during the campaign that the United States could negotiate successfully with Russia and China to combat terrorism, reduce the chance of nuclear war, and negotiate international trade deals that would be fair to the United States. Among Trump's first acts in office was to cancel President Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership and to pull out of the Obama-negotiated United Nations Paris Climate Accord. Two moves certain to threaten international globalists and their central bank financiers. To win the presidency, Trump defeated 16 GOP establishment contenders, plus Hillary Clinton, the overwhelming first choice of international globalists and central bankers worldwide. To appreciate how threatening Trump's election was to the deep state, understand that international globalists and their central bank financiers have had a New World Order hold on the White House since Ronald Reagan left office, through four administrations, including the presidencies of George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Trump won the presidency by defying political correctness and threatening to replace the rule of multinational corporations and borderless international organizations, including both the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, with a return to a populist form of nationalist economics and politics that vowed to put America first. From the moment that Trump surprised pundits across the globe by winning the 2016 presidential election, deep state activists in the United States vowed that Trump would never be permitted to rule effectively. Joined by GOP elite establishment leaders in Washington, House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed that Trump's legislative agenda would be blocked, despite their public assurances of allegiance to the new president. The deep state had been convinced that Hillary would win and that a second Clinton presidency would allow the deep state to continue running the international drug trade while supporting the military-industrial complex in a policy of perpetual war. With Hillary prepared to confront both Russia and China as enemies, the deep state felt reassured that central bankers worldwide would continue to fund U.S. military adventures around the globe. Moreover, with Hillary as president, the deep state could be confident that 2009-like government bailouts would be readily available to keep from exploding the multi-trillion dollar fiat currency debt bubble that imperils the global economy. With Hillary in the White House, central bankers were confident they could print as much fiat currency as was needed to continue funding perpetual military conflicts without worrying about the doubling of the U.S. national debt experienced during Obama's 8 years in office. Multinational corporations could anticipate the expansion of international trade deals without being concerned that Russia and China's competitive advantages would undercut the U.S. by providing readily available cheap labor to government-subsidized commercial operations. Globalists could look forward to continued open borders and a massive influx of Middle Eastern refugees as the U.S. rushed to the finish line of ending U.S. national sovereignty once and for all. The risk the deep state faced if Trump actually succeeded in winning the election was the exposure of four traitorous U.S. presidencies. George H.W. Bush, along with Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, engineered such criminal travesties as the invasion of Iraq, a fast and furious gun-running to the Mexican drug cartels, more illegal gun-running to Libya and Syria, as well as a plan to support the Muslim Brotherhood's penetration of the top levels of the U.S. national security apparatus, including the White House, the National Security Council, and numerous intelligence agencies, including the CIA. If Hillary had won, she would have completed the Obama administration's dictatorial decision to weaponize the federal bureaucracy. The losers would be patriots, clinging to their Bibles and their guns, dumb enough to believe, even today, in the U.S. Constitution and the freedoms our founding fathers bequeathed to all subsequent generations of Americans. With the willing complicity of globalists, central bankers, intelligence operatives, and military leaders around the world, Hillary planned to perpetuate the Clinton Foundation for decades to come as a vast criminal enterprise, designed to enrich Bill, Hillary, Chelsea, and their descendants into perpetuity. As radical socialists in sympathy with Muslim radicals gained control of the Democratic Party, Hillary's 2016 presidential campaign championed a hard-left brand of identity politics. The goal of her anti-hate agenda was to undermine what is left of the American Republic. What Hillary and the hard-left ideology she embraced aimed to destroy was the Judeo-Christian ethics and the free enterprise principles that have been keys to the success of the American experiment. What is at stake today is not just the presidency of Donald J. Trump, but the very survival of a United States of America that allows the Constitution and our fundamental freedoms to continue for future generations. To kill the deep state, Donald J. Trump must defeat Robert Mueller's plan to remove him from office one way or the other, either by impeachment or by declaring him mentally unfit under the terms of the 25th Amendment. To save his presidency, Trump must expose a host of criminally cunning deep state political operatives as enemies to the Constitution, including John Brennan, Eric Holder, Loretta Lynch, James Comey, and Robert Mueller, as well as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. The NSA spying on the American people must end now. The CIA must finally be broken up into a thousand pieces, as John F. Kennedy swore in a promise that cost him his life. Trump must not delay in draining the swamp at the FBI, the DOJ, and the IRS, in addition to the CIA. President Trump must end the deep state's control of the international drug trade, even if doing so requires legalizing a wide range of drugs that can be controlled as we control alcohol today. Under the past four presidencies, the United States has been the leading nation competing in the international arms trade. President Trump must make certain that no Secretary of State will ever repeat Hillary Clinton's secret plan to use the Department of State as a cover to destabilize nations like Libya, or to subsequently run guns illegally through Libya to equip al-Qaeda terrorists fighting in Syria. President Trump must direct the FBI and the Department of Justice to return to their duly constituted duties of faithfully executing and enforcing laws on the books, including laws regarding illegal immigration. The bloated bureaucracy, with its Clinton and Obama holdovers, operates today as a fourth branch of government, enacting its own laws by inventing thousands of rules and regulations. Trump must end this leftist monster, firing bureaucrats by the thousands and closing departments pursuing their own ideological agendas. Trump must put an end to the Federal Reserve System and its bubble-generating fiat currency before central bankers have time to execute their plan of plunging the global economy into a nightmare of global economic depression. The IRS must be disbanded, as the American people reject both the Federal Reserve System and the income tax as unconstitutional pillars on which deep state globalists and central bankers depend to finance their evil, unconstitutional shadow government. While all this will not be accomplished in 1 year, or perhaps even in 1 term, President Trump must begin. This is a war Trump can win, even though, as in the general election itself, the odds are against him. But to win this war, the Trump train must gain momentum against the deep state, proving once again that the so-called basket of deplorables are yet a formidable force, capable of defeating even the deep state's well-established and well-financed traitors. We patriots must today resolve that we are once again the last, best hope to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States and fundamental freedoms we have been bequeathed as Americans. In moments of doubt, we must always recall the fundamental truism of our yet uncertain existence on this small planet. In the end, God wins. Let us persist in our resolve that by supporting President Trump, we have chosen to be on the right side of history. Let us join President Trump in making America great again. With the help of God, we the deplorables pray we will be able to propel President Trump to victory in this project of killing the deep state that we have undertaken together. Part 1. The Deep State Embraces the Hashtag Never Trump Movement. Chapter 1. The Smoking Gun. This man cannot be president. Lisa Page, FBI agent, March 2016. Throughout 2017, despite no clear evidence of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign, the mainstream media continued the negative drumbeat. Obsessed with coverage of FBI Director Comey's firing as obstruction of justice, the mainstream media and deep state forces glossed over Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's own conflict of interest in the case. Rosenstein picked the prosecutor to investigate Comey's firing, even though Rosenstein himself played a central role in that firing. But by the end of 2017, the deep state's grip on the coverage took a shocking turn, with proof of anti-Trump forces at work in the FBI. The turn came with an investigation that Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, undertook to determine if pre-election bias among top officials in the DOJ caused them to make decisions favorable to Hillary Clinton and prejudicial to Donald Trump. On or about December 12, 2017, in advance of General Horowitz releasing emails from top DOJ officials to fulfill an oversight request of the House Judiciary Committee, the Department of Justice, without consulting with General Horowitz, turned over 375 text messages exchanged between FBI counterintelligence agent Peter Strzok and FBI attorney Lisa Page. These messages quickly moved to the center of an intensifying argument by Republican members of Congress that members of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe were biased against President Trump. The 375 released text messages opened up a floodgate of information that strongly suggested the FBI and DOJ had conspired to prevent Hillary Clinton from being prosecuted over her email scandal, while simultaneously setting up the pretext that Donald Trump's campaign had colluded with Russia to prevent Trump from serving as president should he win the 2016 election. The Smoking Gun text message. In total, General Horowitz obtained some 10,000 text messages exchanged between Strzok and Page over their government-issued cell phones from August 2015 to December 2016. The intensity of the anti-Trump hate sentiment shared by Strzok and Page was perhaps magnified by the extramarital affair the two were enjoying while the text messages were exchanged. Also, at that time, both Strzok and Page were working on Mueller's special prosecutor team. Strzok had played a lead role in conducting the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State. In August 2015, Page wrote to Strzok, "I just saw my first Bernie Sanders bumper sticker. Made me want to key the car." Strzok replied, "He's an idiot, like Trump. Figure they cancel each other out." In March 2016, Strzok wondered whether Trump would be a worse president than Senator Ted Cruz. Page answered, "Trump? Yes, I think so." Strzok then added that Trump is awful and an idiot. Strzok called the Republican National Convention in Cleveland pathetic. In a longer message, Strzok complained, he, Trump, appears to have no ability to experience reverence, which is the foundation for any capacity to admire or serve anything bigger than self, to want to learn about anything beyond self, to want to know and deeply honor the people around you. Page wrote back, "He's not ever going to become president, right? Right?" On election day, Strzok saw an election map on television that showed Trump winning, which prompted him to express his horror, calling the map fucking terrifying. The smoking gun text message was dated August 15, 2016, with Strzok telling Page, "I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way Trump gets elected. But I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like an insurance policy in a likely event you die before you're 40. Page does not appear to have responded, but the reference to Andy is to then Associate Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe, a controversial figure in the FBI investigation into Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's email server. What Strzok's message makes clear is that Page and Strzok, in the presence of a high-ranking FBI official, had laid out an insurance policy plan to make sure Trump never served his term as president, even if Trump pulled off a miracle to win the election and beat Strzok and Page's clear favorite, Hillary Clinton. Soon it developed that the insurance policy involved the Russian collusion evidence the FBI had been quietly accumulating against the Trump campaign. The frightening prospect conveyed by Strzok's text message was that a small group of politically biased FBI officials at the very top of the organization were determined to both make sure Hillary was never indicted or prosecuted, and make sure sufficient evidence to impeach Trump was available in the unlikely event that he should be elected president. Put simply, Strzok's text message from August 15, 2016, would be Exhibit 1 should Strzok, Page, and McCabe ever be indicted for treason for plotting a coup d'etat against a legitimately elected president of the United States. What the text message also shows is that the Russian collusion theme was developed briefly during the campaign, but the narrative was not considered particularly important because Obama never made it an issue at that time. But after the election, the Russian collusion story came front and center, the core argument that would be developed in an effort to deny Trump the presidency. Had Hillary been elected president, the nation probably would never have heard anything more about the Russian collusion meme. Hillary did not lose the election because of Russian collusion. Hillary lost the election because she did not pay enough attention to counting Electoral College votes. As the second highest ranking official in counterintelligence, Strzok helped lead the FBI's investigation of Hillary's private email server and approved the Bureau's July 2016 investigation into Russian meddling. Electronic records show that Strzok changed a key phrase in the language FBI Director James Comey used on July 5, 2016, in a public statement designed to describe how former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton handled classified information. Strzok was responsible for striking language that described Clinton's actions as grossly negligent, clearly a crime under national security statutes, and altering it to extremely careless, a phrase designed to suggest that Clinton bore no criminal responsibility for her actions. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Charles Grassley, an Iowa Republican, reacted in anger, writing to the FBI, "Although Director Comey's original version of his statement acknowledged that Secretary Clinton had violated the statute prohibiting gross negligence in the handling of classified information, he nonetheless exonerated her in that early May 2nd draft statement anyway, arguing that this part of the statute should not be enforced. Still, in his prepared remarks, Comey managed to fire a shot across Hillary's bow, making it clear that Hillary's handling of classified material had been dangerously close to the language the statute specified as criminal. By doing this, Comey demonstrated that the deep state was still running the show, even though no one seriously believed Trump had a chance of winning. In August 2017, when Special Counsel Mueller first learned of the text exchange between Strzok and Page, Strzok was ousted from Mueller's team and reassigned to the FBI's Human Relations Department. On August 16, 2017, ABC News reported that Strzok left Mueller's team investigating Russian collusion, although Mueller continued the cover-up, refusing to explain even to Congress why Strzok was dismissed. A little more than a month later, ABC News reported on September 28, 2017, that Mueller's team lost its second investigator, Lisa Page, who had been described as recently as June 2017 by Wired magazine as a veteran trial attorney, a key part of Mueller's investigatory dream team, who had deep experience in money laundering and organized crime cases. Again, Mueller refused to explain even to Congress why Lisa Page was fired. The reason for Strzok's and Page's dismissal from Mueller's special counsel team remained secret until December 2017, when the DOJ shared with Congress a sample of 375 text messages from the 10,000 messages Inspector General Horowitz found Strzok and Page had exchanged between August 2015 and December 2016. Both Special Counsel Mueller and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the DOJ official, initially an Obama appointee, to whom Mueller reported after Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself in the Russia collusion investigation, had covered up all information about the Strzok-Page text messages in order to hide from the public the amount of anti-Trump hatred there was at the head of the FBI and DOJ during the election and afterward, leading to Rosenstein's decision to appoint Mueller as special counsel. Once the American public learned the truth, the credibility of not only Mueller's special counsel investigation, but also the FBI and the DOJ was seriously tarnished. Strzok's involvement in the Clinton email investigation was extensive, with FBI records documenting that Strzok attended the FBI's interview with Hillary Clinton on July 2, 2016, just days before then-FBI Director James Comey read a public statement announcing he was declining to recommend prosecution of Clinton in connection with her use, as Secretary of State, of a private email server. The FBI interview with Clinton was taken without Clinton being placed under oath and without a verbatim transcript being made. Strzok appears to have been involved in a series of FBI decisions that granted immunity to key Clinton aides involved with the private email server controversy, including Clinton's longtime legal confidant, Cheryl Mills. In his counterintelligence position, Strzok also enjoyed liaison with various agencies in the intelligence community, including the CIA, then led by Director John Brennan, a longtime supporter of and advisor to President Barack Obama. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. Campaign finance records show that a political action committee tied to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, an influential Democrat political operative with financial ties to Bill and Hillary Clinton, donated $467,500 to Jill McCabe in 2015 to assist her in a race for a Virginia State Senate seat. Campaign finance records further reveal that the Virginia Democratic Party, over which Governor McAuliffe exerted considerable control, donated an additional $207,788 of support to McCabe's campaign in the form of mailers. This adds up to $675,000 donated by McAuliffe and the Democratic Party in Virginia to McCabe's wife while he was Associate Deputy Director of the FBI and one of a small group at the head of the FBI during the 2016 presidential campaign responsible for investigating Hillary's email server. The 2015 Virginia State Senate race was Jill McCabe's first run for office, and her campaign spent $1.8 million in the losing effort. On October 23, 2016, McCabe wrote an email to the press indicating the Clinton email server investigation had assumed special status and was being moved to the control of a small group of high-ranking people at the FBI headquarters in Washington, which included McCabe. On January 29, 2016, FBI Director James Comey appointed McCabe as Deputy Director of the FBI. When President Trump fired Director James Comey on May 9, 2017, McCabe, then the Deputy Director, became the Acting Director of the FBI. Among the issues DOJ Inspector General Horowitz is investigating is whether McCabe should have recused himself from participating in the FBI's Russia investigation, given the conflicts of interest created by his wife's funding from Terry McAuliffe and the Democratic Party in Virginia. Bruce and Nellie Orr. The Mueller investigation was rocked once again in early December, when the DOJ announced a very senior official, Bruce Orr, had been demoted. Until being demoted, Orr held two titles at the DOJ. Associate Deputy Attorney General, a position that put him four doors down on the fourth floor of Main Justice from his boss, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. And a second position as Director of the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, a program described by DOJ as the centerpiece of the Attorney General's drug strategy. Orr was demoted after evidence collected by the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, chaired by Representative Devin Nunes, a Republican from California, revealed that Orr had met during the 2016 presidential campaign with Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agent at the center of the controversy surrounding an opposition research dossier prepared against candidate Donald Trump. Additionally, House Intelligence Committee investigators have determined that Orr met shortly after the election with Glenn Simpson, the founder of Fusion GPS, the opposition research firm that hired Steele to complete the dossier with funds supplied by Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee. The payments to Fusion GPS from the Clinton campaign and the DNC were made indirectly, laundered as legal payments to the Seattle-based law firm Perkins Coie, a longtime advisor to Democratic Party politicians, including President Barack Obama. As will be more completely discussed in Chapter 7, the FBI embraced the Fusion GPS dossier despite a body of evidence suggesting its research into the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russia was flawed by the same anti-Trump bias that appears to have permeated the top echelons of the FBI and the DOJ, casting doubts on the integrity of Mueller's special counsel investigation. From published reports, Strzok, then acting in his counterintelligence position, was the FBI official who first took possession of the Fusion GPS Russia dossier, possibly as early as 5 months before the November 2016 election. According to Fox News senior judicial analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano, the FBI appears to have offered the former British spy Christopher Steele $50,000 if he could corroborate the Fusion GPS findings. Appearing before the House Intelligence Committee on December 13, 2017, Deputy Director Rosenstein refused to answer directly as to whether the FBI used the Fusion GPS Russia dossier as the basis to obtain a warrant from the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, to conduct electronic surveillance on members of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign. If the Fusion GPS Russia dossier proves to have included false information derogatory to Trump, the FBI's use of the document runs the risk of compromising Mueller's Russia investigation, especially if the FBI used the Fusion GPS dossier as the basis for obtaining court-authorized approval to conduct electronic surveillance on members of the Trump campaign. Bruce Orr was demoted not only because he refused to disclose his meeting with Steele and Simpson over the Fusion GPS dossier to the FBI, but also because he failed to disclose that his wife, Nellie Orr, was hired by Fusion GPS to work on the Russia dossier. It turns out that Fusion GPS put Nellie on the payroll because of her obvious close ties to the FBI, and because she is a Russian speaker with ties to the CIA, who holds advanced academic degrees in Russian literature and history. Federal Communications Commission records also document that Nellie Orr obtained an amateur ham radio license on May 23, 2016, after she was hired by Fusion GPS. Those investigating Nellie Orr's role in the controversy suggest she might have done so to communicate outside the normal risk of communication intercepts with Christopher Steele, the British intelligence agent responsible for producing the Fusion GPS opposition research dossier on Donald Trump, and or with various sources in Russia that Steele was utilizing to develop the opposition research he planned to use to sink the Trump campaign. Glenn Simpson, a co-founder of Fusion GPS, hired Nellie Orr the month before, in April 2016, to work as a subcontractor for Russian contacts, including those purporting to have highly inflammatory but unsubstantiated allegations believed to be detrimental to Trump's campaign if made public. Nellie Orr speaks fluent Russian and holds a BA in Russian history and literature from Harvard and a PhD in Russian history from Stanford. She has been a Russia scholar at the Wilson Center and taught at Vassar College. Nellie and Bruce Orr are both listed as working in a June 2010 National Institute of Justice Expert Working Group on International Organized Crime, with Bruce Orr working as the chief of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section, Criminal Division, U.S. Department of Justice, and Nellie Orr identified as a researcher with the CIA's Open Source Works in Washington. The Wilson Center identifies Orr as an assistant professor at Vassar College, who, from August 1, 1997, through October 1, 1997, had a short-term grant with the Kennan Institute to study collective farmers of Russia's western region after collectivization and under German occupation. A resume for Nellie Orr, posted on the internet, shows she was a former review editor for H Russia, a member of HNET Humanities and Social Sciences Online. Listed as her major published work to date was a research paper titled After Collectivization, Social Capital and Local Politics in Rural Western Russia, 1933 to 1937, an article that was translated into Russian. Nellie Orr's maiden name is Hauke. She is the daughter of Dr. Kathleen Armstrong Hauke, a resident of Arlington, Virginia, who was a writer known for popularizing the works of African-American journalist Ted Poston, who traveled to the Soviet Union with poet Langston Hughes in 1932. A book titled Adventures in Russian Historical Research documents that Orr was in Moscow doing research, supposedly for her doctoral dissertation at the Lenin Library in Moscow during 1989. Andrew Weissman and Sally Yates. An email obtained by Judicial Watch through a Freedom of Information Act FOIA request shows that on the night of January 30, 2017, former DOJ prosecutor Andrew Weissman sent an email to former Acting Attorney General Sally Yates with the subject line, "I am so proud of you." In the three-sentence body of the email, Weissman said, "And in awe, thank you so much. All my deepest respects." The background of the memo was that President Trump had just fired Yates after an escalating crisis in which Yates, who had served as Deputy Attorney General under President Obama, had refused to carry out President Trump's executive order that the political left was interpreting to be a travel ban against Muslims. Tom Fitton of Judicial Watch said the email was an astonishing and disturbing find. Weissman had just taken a leave with the DOJ to serve as a top prosecutor on Mueller's special counsel team. Since 2015, Weissman had headed the DOJ's criminal fraud division. Andrew Weissman, a key prosecutor on Robert Mueller's team, praised Obama DOJ holdover Sally Yates after she lawlessly thwarted President Trump, Fitton said. "How much more evidence do we need that the Mueller operation has been irredeemably compromised by anti-Trump partisans?" As a prosecutor, Weissman had a reputation for being fast and loose with the rules in his zeal to obtain convictions. Sidney Powell, a former U.S. attorney whose 2014 book, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice, is a shocking expose of prosecutorial impropriety that she maintains runs rampant today among Department of Justice prosecutors, warns that Andrew Weissman, a federal prosecutor who is now part of Mueller's team, is capable of extorting guilty pleas. Powell points to the example of former Arthur Andersen partner David Duncan, who withdrew his guilty plea in the Enron case after Weissman extorted him to testify for the government to obtain the wrongful conviction of Arthur Andersen. Noting that Weissman was the driving force behind the indictment of Arthur Andersen in the Enron case, Weissman used these special tactics he developed prosecuting organized criminals, convinced that even if some of his special tactics went outside the bounds, the ends justified the means when prosecuting serious bad guys. Later in the book, Powell points out that Weissman forced Duncan into a guilty plea by misrepresenting Duncan's innocent conduct in the case as criminal. Chapter 2: A Shattering Defeat and the Left's Paradise Lost. The election of Donald Trump to the presidency is nothing less than a tragedy. David Remnick, The New Yorker. At 11:05 a.m. Eastern Time, on June 16, 2015, when Donald and Melania Trump descended from the mezzanine of Trump Tower in New York City to announce Donald Trump's candidacy for president, U.S. politics entered a revolutionary era. Almost immediately, the mainstream media began characterizing Trump's candidacy as a joke, predicting his demise. Trump would never win in the primaries, most insisted. Then, when Trump surged in the primaries, the mainstream media changed the theme, predicting Trump would never get enough delegates for the first ballot win at the Republican National Nominating Convention in Cleveland. In the end, Trump's victory in the primaries was decisive, winning 41 primaries and getting some 500 delegates more than the 1,237 he needed to secure the GOP presidential nomination on the first ballot. Even as the nation prepared to vote on November 8, 2016, commentators on cable television remained unanimous in their opinions that Trump was losing badly in the polls and that Hillary was certain to win the presidency. Democrats began the 2016 presidential campaign with a mortal lock on 246 of the 270 electoral votes needed to win. Pundit after pundit insisted that Trump would lose some of the largest states with the greatest number of electoral votes, including both New York and California. According to the experts, he had no electoral path available to win enough of the remaining states to get the 270 electoral votes needed for victory. Yet at 2:45 a.m. Eastern Time, after the voting was done, television networks announced to a stunned nation that Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes had gone to Donald Trump, making him the president-elect of the United States. Donald Trump had defied all odds, winning a surreal victory that sent the deep state into an immediate panic. A leaked video showed an elated Clinton family prematurely celebrating victory on election night based on early results indicating that Hillary would be elected president, just as predicted. The video shows Chelsea running into her mother's open arms, embracing a smiling Hillary, while Bill Clinton claps his hands and jumps up and down like an excited schoolboy. Too bad for the Clintons, the elation did not last long. In R. Emmett Tyrell's blog on the American Spectator website, sources reported that Hillary flew into a rage after it was clear she had lost. According to Secret Service officers, Hillary pounded the furniture and screamed obscenities, throwing objects at staff in an uncontrollable fury. The glass ceiling. As the New York Post noted in reporting Clinton's historic defeat, Hillary had chosen every detail of her election night so as to mark her moment in history, from the glass ceiling at Manhattan's Javits Center, where hundreds of supporters were gathered to hear her victory speech, to the top-floor suite the Clintons had reserved at the Peninsula Hotel, located at Fifth Avenue and 55th Street. Hillary had selected that hotel so she could personally see Trump Tower, home to the foe she was set to crush. Hillary's communications team decamped to the Javits Center in the Hell's Kitchen section of Manhattan, where preparations for her victory party were being made, the New York Post noted. The venue, which would fill with Hillary aides, donors, friends, and well-wishers over the course of the day, was chosen in large part because of its distinctive feature, a glass ceiling. If everything went as planned, it would be the glass ceiling of the presidency that lay shattered under Hillary by the end of the night. At 2 a.m. Eastern Time, Hillary's campaign chairman, John Podesta, appeared at the podium in the Javits Center to say, "Well, folks, I know you have been here a long time, and it's been a long night and a long campaign, but I can say we can wait a little longer, can't we? They are still counting votes, and every vote should count. Several states are too close to call, so we're not going to have anything more to say tonight." That was it. No concession. "So listen to me," Podesta continued. "Everybody should head home. We should get some sleep." But President Obama phoned Hillary at the peninsula to impress upon her the inevitable. The White House had concluded that the electoral map, as reported by the television coverage, was correct. Despite all the predictions, including nearly unanimous polling data that predicted Hillary would win easily, she had lost. Obama urged Hillary to telephone Trump and concede. Finally, Hillary reluctantly agreed to speak with Trump by telephone. In a short call, Hillary conceded, "Congratulations, Donald." She said, "I'll be supportive of the country's success, and that means your success as president." Hillary's defeat, an American tragedy. The next day, David Remnick, the author of a 2010 book titled The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama, delivered the political left's verdict on Trump's unanticipated victory in The New Yorker. "The election of Donald Trump to the presidency is nothing less than a tragedy for the American Republic, a tragedy for the Constitution, and a triumph for the forces, at home and abroad, of nativism, authoritarianism, misogyny, and racism." Remnick wrote, "Trump's shocking victory, his ascension to the presidency, is a sickening event in the history of the United States and liberal democracy." Already, Remnick was lamenting the passing out of office of Barack Obama. "On January 20th, 2017, we will bid farewell to the first African-American president, a man of integrity, dignity, and generous spirit, and witness the inauguration of a con who did little to spurn endorsement by forces of xenophobia and white supremacy," he insisted. "It is impossible to react to this moment with anything less than revulsion and profound anxiety." This was the first salvo suggesting that the Hillary camp was not about to accept defeat so easily. Clearly, the political left could not allow American voters to elect to the presidency a person David Remnick and like-minded ideologues in the New York, Washington, and Los Angeles media elite had designated as not qualified to be president. Donald Trump was so politically incorrect, the elite felt certain that somehow he would have to be barred from taking the oath of office. The next day, on November 9th, 2016, Hillary gave a formal concession speech, saying, "Last night I congratulated Donald Trump and offered to work with him on behalf of our country. I hope that he will be a successful president for all people." The emphasis on "all people" appeared to be a subtle reference to Hillary's repeated charges that Trump's campaign was a divisive one, designed to appeal only to the reactionary impulses of white supremacists seeking to roll back the social justice achievements of the Obama administration. Within 24 hours of her formal concession speech, an angry and aggrieved Hillary refused to take responsibility for her loss to Trump, pointing her finger instead at Russia. Resentful that Obama had not done more to make the case that Vladimir Putin had targeted her in a determined effort to throw the election to Trump. The Russian collusion meme emerges. During the campaign, the deep state had begun planting the seeds of a key strategy it would use to declare Trump's victory illegitimate, so as to bar him from the White House. American intelligence agencies have told the White House they now have high confidence that the Russian government was behind the theft of emails and documents from the Democratic National Committee, according to federal officials who have been briefed on the evidence, the New York Times reported on July 26, 2016. This followed an article published by the Times on June 14, 2016, claiming Two groups of Russian hackers working for competing government intelligence agencies penetrated computer systems of the Democratic National Committee and gained access to emails, chats, and a trove of opposition research against Donald J. Trump, according to the party and a cybersecurity firm. The newspaper further reported that the DNC had called in CrowdStrike, a private security firm which identified Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear as the two Russian intelligence agencies culpable for the hacking, although the article failed to document precisely how CrowdStrike determined the hack was from Russian intelligence agencies. The New York Times assured readers that, again, unnamed investigators had attributed the hacks to a person who called himself Guccifer 2.0, identified as an agent of the GRU, Russia's military intelligence service. The Times reporting quickly became the accepted version of events, such that anyone doubting that the Russians had hacked the DNC would be tagged as advancing a conspiracy theory. Then on July 27, 2016, at a press conference in Miami, Florida, Trump commented, "Russia, if you are listening, I hope you are able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing." This was in reference to the 30,000 State Department emails Hillary destroyed after deciding that they were personal and within the scope of my personal privacy, despite knowing they were subject to preservation orders under a congressional subpoena. Trump concluded the press conference by stressing that he would treat Vladimir firmly, but there's nothing I can think of that I'd rather do than have Russia friendly as opposed to the way they are right now, so that we can go and knock out ISIS together. This was all Hillary campaign operatives and the mainstream media needed to charge that Trump had been the driving force behind the theft of DNC emails, in collusion with Russia, to make sure Hillary lost the election. For damage control, the Trump campaign was forced to walk back Trump's statement, claiming that all Trump meant was that if Russia had the 30,000 emails Hillary had destroyed, they should be turned over to the FBI. Despite the lack of verifiable proof, Hillary and the mainstream media made the Russia narrative during the campaign one that suggested Trump had worked with Russia to win the election by hacking the DNC. According to the developing Russian collusion meme, Trump's devious plan was to induce Russia to release to DC Leaks and WikiLeaks the purloined Democratic emails and other confidential Clinton documents stolen by Guccifer 2.0 and or Russian intelligence agencies identified only as Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. During the first presidential debate at Hofstra University in Hampstead, New York, Hillary returned to the Russia meme. "There's no doubt now that Russia has used cyber attacks against all kinds of organizations in our country, and I'm deeply concerned about this," Hillary said. "I know Donald's very praiseworthy of Vladimir Putin, but Putin is playing a really tough, long game here." Then a few minutes later, she added, "I was so shocked when Donald publicly invited Putin to hack into Americans. That's just unacceptable." Notice that Trump's initial statement did not invite Russia to hack the DNC computers. Trump was making an offhand quip, suggesting that if the New York Times' unnamed intelligence sources were right and Russia was responsible for hacking the DNC computers, then maybe Russia had possession of the 30,000 emails Hillary had destroyed. The point that a deep state narrative need not be true is important. Even distorted, as Hillary distorted Trump's offhand press conference comment, a meme can take hold if it's repeated enough times without question or criticism. Over a relatively short time, the distorted version becomes the official version of what Trump said and what he meant. From this point on, the deep state's assertion that Trump was in collusion with Russia to steal the election from Hillary was firmly planted in the mainstream media narrative of campaign events. The deep state resolves to deny Trump the White House. On January 6, 2016, a partially declassified intelligence community assessment commissioned by President Obama and issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, DNI, concluded that Russia had interfered with the U.S. presidential election in a bid to help Trump. "We assess Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election. Russia's goals were to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency, the DNI report said. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. We have high confidence in these judgments, the report continued. The report concluded that Putin most likely wanted to discredit Secretary Clinton because he has publicly blamed her since 2011 for inciting mass protests against his regime in late 2011 and early 2012, and because he holds a grudge for comments he almost certainly saw as disparaging him. The DNI report stressed that the CIA, FBI, and National Security Agency, NSA, all agreed with this judgment. With this report, the deep state positioned the Russian collusion meme as its first choice strategy for blocking Donald Trump from becoming president. In contrast, by December 13, 2000, Al Gore had abandoned his presidential bid, accepting the decision of the Supreme Court as a campaign-ending decision. In December 2016, the DNI intelligence report gave Democrats new hope that Hillary Clinton may yet be inaugurated as president if Trump's collusion with Russia could be proven. With the publication of this intelligence community assessment, the deep state game to deny Donald J. Trump the presidency was on in earnest. As former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said on Meet the Press in March 2017, "We did not include any evidence in our report, and I say our, that's NSA, FBI, and CIA, with my office, the Director of National Intelligence, that had anything, that had any reflection of collusion between members of the Trump campaign and the Russians. There was no evidence of that included in our report." Paradise Lost. Hillary not only lost the opportunity to shatter the glass ceiling on election night 2016, her supporters also lost the opportunity to create a far-left utopia that they felt was certainly within their grasp. With Hillary as president, Obama could look forward to a continuation of his 8-year Saul Alinsky-like effort to fundamentally transform the United States into a socialist nation that warmly embraced radical Islamic extremists, including the Muslim Brotherhood. With the Democrats thrown into disarray by Hillary's defeat, the party resolved to move further to the left, determined to pursue a radical hard-left agenda, consistent with the deep state's determination that Donald Trump must never be permitted to govern. After 8 years in office, Barack Obama had set the stage for a Hillary Clinton presidency that would, once and for all time, recast the American charter with new legislation and Supreme Court decisions that would transform what Obama had achieved into a final rewriting of the American covenant. Where our founding fathers desired to limit government power to protect and preserve individual liberties, the Democrats under Obama and Hillary sought to establish a Marxist-leaning social welfare state consistent with globalist one-world government ambitions. Hillary Clinton's speeches to Goldman Sachs left no doubt that her political philosophy called for statist control over an international bank-driven finance system, supporting the development of international business dominating a global economy. Hillary's America. Imagine how different the United States would have been had Hillary won the presidential election, defeating Donald Trump in 2016. Her ambitions to extend Obama's social welfare state and identity politics to a new level was clear, given her many campaign pronouncements and the public policy statements published on her campaign website. Hillary and her supporters felt that with her victory, the achievement of a totalitarian far-left utopia was within their reach. In short, if Hillary had won, the hard-left Alinsky acolytes taking over the Democratic Party would have had the chance to eliminate from the United States all those Hillary defined as irredeemable deplorables, that is, people she saw as racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, and Islamophobic Trump supporters. In her post-election book, What Happened, Hillary speculated that her presidency would have been transformative by implementing higher minimum wages, expanding social welfare programs, and increasing government intervention into our economic and social lives by a host of new regulations imposed by an ever-expanding core of unelected bureaucrats. The Deep State's plan to recover Paradise Lost. The sense of frustration felt by the left with Hillary Clinton's demise was so enormous as to be almost immeasurable. The November 2016 edition of the leftist publication The Nation appeared with a black cover, on which were printed the following words, with the first appearing in small print in gray, then proceeding to large print in white. Mourn, resist, organize, onward. And so many of our hopes for free public college, a livable minimum wage, expanded social security, a path to universal health care, paid family leave, an end to private prisons, the abolition of the death penalty, now lie shattered along with the prospect of an administration that, whatever its limitations, had been shown to be open to pressure from the left, wrote D.D. Guttenplan, an at-large editor for the publication. Which means we have to apply even greater pressure from the left, to march in greater numbers, to shout out louder against injustice, and to summon and be prepared to sustain every day massive nonviolent civil disobedience on a scale not seen in this country for decades. To be so close with what appeared to be a certain win for Hillary Clinton, and yet to lose was devastating for Hillary's most committed supporters. Hillary Democrats were determined to see if the mounting resistance could prevent Trump from being inaugurated. If the resistance movement failed there, the focus would shift to identifying strategies that could lead to his impeachment and removal from office. At a minimum, Democratic Party resistance could transform into an obstruction movement that would prevent Donald Trump from enacting into legislation the public policy objectives he had articulated while running for president. An aggressive Democratic Party resist and obstruct movement, even if unsuccessful, could impair the effectiveness of the Trump presidency. But for these dark, resentful, but determined Democratic ambitions to succeed, the Democrats knew they could count on the willing and enthusiastic cooperation of the deep state. Chapter 3. The Deep State Targets Trump. So I don't think it's Trump versus Obama. I think it's really the deep state versus the president, the duly elected president. Representative Thomas Massey, Republican Kentucky, February 2017. As evidence of the deep state's antipathy toward Trump, one needs to look no further than at the illegal unmasking of U.S. citizens that took place numerous times during the Trump campaign. This unmasking is a certain breach of the democratic process and shows the deep state was out to get Trump and would violate the law to do so. The concept of deep politics entered the national dialogue in a serious manner when the American public realized that there were dark forces at work behind shocking events. In 1976, the Church Committee concluded that the Warren Commission covered up the role organized crime had played working with the CIA to assassinate President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Ever since Watergate, the American public have come to expect that what we observe in the overt politics reported by the mainstream media has nothing to do with the deep politics in which hidden forces predominate. The truth of the American Republic in the new millennium is that we have become accustomed to mobsters working with government intelligence agency drug dealers, financed by Wall Street and banks that are too big to fail. In the background are K Street lobbyists in Washington ready to shape public policy and congressional legislation in favor of international corporations and the global elite who pay their hefty lobbying fees. The term deep state was actually coined in Turkey and is said to be a system composed of high-level elements within the intelligence services, military, security, judiciary, and organized crime, wrote retired congressional staff budget analyst Mike Lofgren in his 2016 book, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. Lofgren has defined traditional Washington partisan politics as the tip of the iceberg that a public watching C-SPAN sees daily, and which is theoretically controllable via elections. But the deep state operates according to its own compass, regardless of who is formally in power. This chapter explores three short vignettes from U.S. history that demonstrate why President Trump must take seriously the threat to his presidency and his life represented by a deep state that remains determined to remove him from office. Unable to accept that Donald Trump might win the 2016 elections, the NSA, in cooperation with CIA Director John